Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi, whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
We are continuing with the Upanishad, Isha Upanishad. Isha meaning, as you know, the true self, or the no self. The face of truth is covered with a brilliant golden lid. That do thou remove, O fosterer, for the law of truth, for sight. O fosterer, O soul seer, O ordainer, O illuminating sun, O power of the Father of all creatures, marshal thy rays, draw together thy light, the luster which is thy most blessed form of all, that in thee I behold the Purusha there and there. He am I. Purusha is another term for the self. And as this whole Upanishad is based, and it is the greatest of all the Upanishads, it is based on the fact that God is everywhere. And so this seer says, you know, the Purusha there and there, meaning he has seen him everywhere. That the Son has seen the Father everywhere. The Purusha there and there, he am I. So, and now it speaks of sight and the power of creatures. So we come to Shakti, and this is the Great Mother. This is the mother of nature, because nature itself is born of the creativeness of this Great Mother. In the Kabbalistic system, she is known as Bina, the Black Mother. Isis, she was called in ancient Egypt, the mother who helped the son, who helped her son find the father. Christianity calls her Mary, the Virgin Mother, the one who gives birth to the son. This myth, you know, that is to be taken not too literally, but the Virgin Mother, of course, is the Great Mother. Isis, Bina. There was also another name for the mother, Mut, in ancient Egypt. And this, from this thing comes our word mother, which also is Mary. Mary means mother. It is the mother out of which all forms rise and in whom we all have our sustenance. We live in the mother, we are of the mother. It is the mother that has given us this body. This is the mother. And in India, the worship of Shakti, the mother, is one of the oldest and the most widespread religions in the world, the worship of Mother. Now, the Shaktas, that is that sect of the Shaktism, they also come under the cloak of Hinduism. Hinduism, you know, takes in, is a broad blanket that takes in a lot of things. It takes all the sects and all the creeds which have arisen in India from ancient of times, and also if something comes from another land into India, she takes it and makes it her own, and it also falls under the rank of Hinduism. That's why Buddhism went. You know, it was came out of Hinduism and sort of went back into Hinduism in India. You know, they, and you know, a long, long time ago, 100,000 years, maybe more, you know, when the ice was moving south. It was the ice, big icebergs, you know, over the land. They were moving toward Europe and coming through Lapland and coming through Finland and through Norway and Denmark, and they were moving into what is now Germany. And this cold was coming closer and closer. And so the winters were longer and longer, and people couldn't find so much to eat anymore. They couldn't grow things, whatever it is that they grew. So some of these people fled from it. They went south. And, you know, think how long this must have taken. I mean, even for the people to go, to make up their minds to go. You know, huge mountains of ice don't go down the road at 50 miles an hour. You know, they may be 3 inches in 100 years. Now, those who remained in Northern Europe were called the Aryans. They faced the ice, and they became a very strong people, so that there is today a strong stock of these people. Others left. They went to India, they went to Persia, and they're also called the Aryans. The word Aryan means holy, something like holy. They're these holy people that remained and left. And today there are in Europe and in India, and there's a few in America, direct descendants of these ancient Aryans. You know, this is what Hitler was trying to do, make a perfect race of Aryans, perfect people. You know. And it is thought that Bodhidharma, you know, coming from Persia, he had blue eyes and a red beard, and, you know, was a tall man, and they thought he was Persian, but the Persian out of the Aryan stock, Aryan descendant, you know, he had this stuff. So this is, you know, a little bit of background. Anyway, when these Aryans came to India all this long ago, they found a religion that they called Brahmanism. The people of India, they were called the Dravidians. They were an amalgamation of racial elements, and so was their religion, of course, then. And also included in this was the Aborigines of India. And it was among this heterogeneous population that the religion of Brahmanism rose, you know, to a certain level. And the very early Hindu writings, you know, they tell about this transition from the Dravidian worship of the elements and the phenomena that is associated with the processes of generation, the fertility. So at the very beginning, they had elements and fertility rites. And then it grew into a more abstract philosophy, which they called Brahmanism, because Brahman was their word for God. Now, the Aryans arriving there and seeing this, they began to dominate over these people, who were still rather primitive, and they took over Brahmanism and evolved it even more. And so they determined the direction of, at that time, of the Indian culture. Now, Brahmanism under the Aryans gave India its moral and social unity, and it pulled it together and sort of made a nation out of all of these peoples in this country, huh? So we have this system of Brahmanism, of religious rites, founded by these early priests and the Aryans, the Aryan Hindus, now they're called. Now, Indian thought, I'm talking about India because this is where the Upanishads come from, and we might as well have a little background too, it seems to me. I keep dropping the background in with this thing. Indian religious thought has come through three stages. The first was the Vedas. The Vedas are tremendously ancient. Some people think that the Aryans brought them with them when they came, you know, like 50,000 years ago, 100,000 years ago when they came in. Then there's the Brahmanism, and then there's Hinduism. Vedism, you know, out of which the Vedas were finally written, was a period of revelation, that which was revealed. These ancient but became teachers. Things were revealed to them. We say revealed. We sit for meditation, and we have an insight, and we say it was revealed to us. Brahmanism was the era of organization, and Hinduism is a period of interpretation. So this is what they're doing now, is interpreting Brahmanism and the Vedas. This is what we're doing with the Upanishads. And the Upanishads come out of the Vedas, and we're today interpreting a couple of sentences. Now, within this Brahmanism is what is called the cult or the sect of the Shaktas, which is the worship of Shakti, the mother, the feminine. Tantra yoga falls under this. There's a Hindu tantra, and there is a Buddhist tantra. Buddhist tantra finds its home in the Tibetan Buddhism. There are a great many people who think of the tantras, that is, so we come to the Shakti, you know, a sect that is just a lot of wild superstition and a bunch of occult humbug, you know. But if you look behind all that humbug, there is a great deal to be gained and understood about yourself. Yeah? And then you will understand that immorality is not the end and the aim of the cult of the mother, the Shakti, or the Tantra. Shakti, she who gives birth. She who gives birth. She has given you birth, and she gives birth to the sun. She who gives birth. The mysticism, the mystical part of this Shakti sect, is built on the basis of unity. Unity of the soul with God. It's one. The unity of all with God, with Brahman. And so it is stated in the oldest Upanishad, you know. All is He. This Brahman, or we might say Nirguna Brahm, Nirguna Brahm, of which nothing can be said because it has no qualities. It's not good, it's not bad, it's not near, it's not far. It's not within, and it's not without. It is not this, and it is not this, and it is not that. So in India, they finally say, neti neti. This highest principle, this divine principle, is the eternal primeval energy, Shakti, out of which everything is created. They analyzed in this whole system so minutely this energy out of which everything was created. Now, Indian thinkers with whom this Shaktism originated, they believed that the, shall we say, the supermost deity, the highest deity, the highest creative principle, should be brought to the human mind, that the knowledge of it should be brought to the human mind, that the mind should be trained to recognize it, you know, not through the word father, but through the word mother. And so, in this thinking, why we have Prakrit, the primeval matter, the prima materia, bina. Prakrit, you know. She who stands in contrast to Purusha, you know, that's the self. It's the male element. Now remember, this is all in you. And the play between these two, the feminine and the masculine in you, you know, create the multiplicity. And so in the whole cosmos, they create the multiplicity. When Purusha enters Prakrit, she that has been in chaos now becomes order. See, this cosmos appears. Forms appear. Numbers appear. And for Purusha, you know, he finds such delight in what he sees, you know, and he is entertained by it, and he is identified with it. But he must wake up to find out who he is. See, he must extricate himself from all this so-called delight. Pull himself out to be himself, not just identified with all of this. See, this is the philosophy of the Samkhya Yoga. And it was Kapila, so-called, that is given the credit for this Samkhya Yoga. And Samkhya is a system which means order. It's numbers. Numbers. So they have done just that. It is, difficult. The bowels of India, you know, follow Samkhya Yoga. That's spelled B-A-U-L, bowels of India. They follow this Samkhya Yoga. Well, and they will spend years on one point. And always it is to look within. And the teacher may give them one point, and they are to observe this one point until they thoroughly understand this one point. And then they can move to another point. And they train themselves to be thusly observing. You know. Now, the energy of Brahman Shakti, we can say the energy of God, Brahman Shakti, and we don't separate them, and yet the creativeness of God, Shakti, energy, the feminine principle. And every woman is regarded as an embodiment of this deity. All the women are Brahman Shakti. It is called the goddess within women, within woman. And you know, this is, if you go by the bookstores at all, well, you know that this is touted in psychological circles today, to find the goddess in you for women, huh? The goddess, you know, there's several books out and several systems out of this. Most of it sort of, I think, falls back onto Jung. But this concept of woman as the mother, woman is the energy of God. It's led to a, in some areas and with some people, to a what is so-called worship, and we do put it in quotes, worship of women that are these wild orgies. And this, of course, is not what it's supposed to be, and not certainly not religion. It's just giving desire a passport to do what it wants. Yeah. Now, the Shakti doctrine is monistic. There is one God. But from there on out, it's rather complex and rather esoteric. It has this very tender concept of the motherhood of God. And so that it is this motherhood of God is that of God which produces and maintains the universe and then withdraws. Again, therefore, the universe withdraws with it, and everything that is withdraws with it. So, and in India, we have this, you know, all is Maya. You don't worry about anything, all is Maya. You just have to live through it. Maybe another time you'll have better luck. All is Maya. Everything is unreal. It's all a dream. You're just dreaming the dream. But the Maya, you know, also it kind of comes from mother. And it's a veil, like, over reality, which, of course, we have put there because of we see a world of appearance. This is Maya, you know. There are, it's like mists or fogs in which the disciple, the sadhana, wanders until he finds something which will lead him out. There's always something which will lead you out. It's like Judas led Jesus out of the garden. It was necessary. Maya is sometimes considered, you know, as Shakti. Now, Shakti, this divine mother, we first can think about her as our earthy mother, in this, because this is her body and her emotions, and this is what she's given us, these elements. Huh? And then one thinks of her from a man's point of view as his wife. She is this divine energy because she also gives birth to his child. And then she again reveals herself in old age, in disease, and in death. She withdraws then, you see. It is she who manifests and she who withdraws. And in this withdrawal, she again takes to herself the body. And in India, of course, the body is placed on a funeral pyre and consumed by flames, which are hers, and all of the elements of the body return from whence they came to the mother who gave it. We give it back. The Purusha, in a way, gives it back. Huh? You know, in Christianity, we say dust to dust. Well, that's the elements of the body to return to the elements of the mother. Now, if we're just talking about religion, of course, eventually, if you keep talking about it, you're going to find that talking is an intellectual exercise. And as long as it's only an intellectual exercise, of what use are words like Atman, Ishvara, Jivatman, Parusha, and so on, huh? And Christ, you know, for those who do injury to others? The words mean not very much. They're still just exercising the mind. They're pushing things around in their head. Huh? Religion is kindness. The Buddha is a compassionate Buddha. Huh? It is compassion. It is also a very practical activity. The mind, and therefore the body, in a way, must be trained One does not just automatically jump into a higher state of consciousness because one is so enamored of oneself that one thinks it is due me. No, it's work. The Purusha must extricate himself from even that, you see, and that takes some training. I mean, I know you sit, but you don't very often really consider it as training, but you are training your minds. You are preparing yourself. Now, within this Shakti, this creativeness, each one of us, every man, woman, and child, so that includes you and me, huh? Yeah. We have latent within us a vast source of power. Yeah. Shakti. The word Shakti comes from the Sanskrit root shak, you know, which means to do or not to do or to be able to do or the power with which we do. We move with what? There's a power with which I move. There is a power with which you sit in that chair. There is a power with which you look. You know, that with which you look has got a power in it. Huh? And you think with the power. You are able to think. You are able to do with your mind because of Shakti. The problem is, instead of her just being in us latent doing all of these things, to bring her to the fore so we can see her objectively and say, oh yeah, that's creativeness, that's Shakti. How really to be able to see her? You know? To bring her into her own action in us. And for that we need something more than talk. We need training to see this energy. Huh? Now, when someone says that Shiva, who is the consort of Shakti, when Shiva speaks, or when God speaks, or when Brahman speaks, you know, whatever name you're going to give it, huh? And gave us great poems like Savitri, you know, or the Ramayana, or the Bhagavad Gita, or any of the mantras, or any of the tantras, it does not mean that God is standing here, that maybe he materialized, and he took a reed, and he wrote on some bark paper, or he wrote on some reeds. Mm-mm. No, we can't even say that about Moses and the tablets. Who actually chiseled out all these things on the tablets? You think God really stood there and did that? Huh? It's very, you know, we must disabuse our minds of some of these things so we're not quite so children-like in our myth-believing. It means that the divine consciousness to which we give the name Brahman or God, this state of consciousness inspired a man to so write or to so teach, you know, a particular doctrine. And if teaching or anything like that, it doesn't mean that this God is standing there whispering in his ear, now you will say this, and now you will say that. No. It's that these things arise in consciousness from the very source, and from the roots within the mother. What is done in this world is done through man. See that you do well. And then someone might ask, well, how do we know what is right and true? What is right and true? I am doing this and this and this. Is it right? Is it true what I'm doing? Is it true what I am thinking? by its fruits. You know, he said it, by its fruits you shall know them. It is not enough to say, well, Brahman said blah, 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 or that Brahman or God said blah, 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 blah. In India, there is the test. And the test comes out of the Ayurveda. One of the Vedas that has to do with healing. It is a system of medicine. It is a healing system, and it's called Ayurveda. And Henry at one time said that, you know, when we went to, what was his name down there? Singh, Professor Singh. That the way he functioned in giving medicine, that it was rather obvious that he had studied Ayurveda in India. No, he was an Indian anyway. Huh? A medicine is true if it cures. That's what they say. If we have an ailment, and not necessarily, I'm not talking about physical ailments, but that too, but you know, we have psychological hang-ups, ailments. You know, we have mental hang-ups, ailments, which are very difficult for us to see. I mean, extremely difficult, because here we are so identified with it that we can't see it. It's got to be, and if it's set over there, such as I can see the rose very objectively, it's seemingly separate from me, you know. Oh yeah, now I can see that it is red, and one is red and one is white. That's the red one is for all living mothers. Yeah. A medicine is true if it cures. And so the Indian test is that of actual experience. When you experience that particular state on which you are focused, then it is true. Words indicate, if you can pick them up and hold them, you know, and you have the experience, then the medicine is true. See, that's Zen, huh? Yeah. See, the medicine is true if it changes you. If it changes an element within you. I mean, say there is a particular energy that is whirled, and you don't even like it, that you don't, you hate somebody, or you have nasty thoughts, and you really don't like that, you know. You do something about it, and when they are no more, when they are gone, then the medicine, whatever medicine you used, cured. Now, having been given this form, this body by this great mother, and she takes care of it through our existence, we help and we hinder. But she's always trying to keep it in balance. And then in time, we give it back to her. And these elements, as I say, disperse to the area to which they belong. The chemicals are go to the chemicals and, you know, it's all. Mm-hmm. So the body is over there, all dispersed again. And then energy will pick it up again and it will form another body. And energy will pick it up again and form another body. And it is given back. So everything in your body has been used over and over and over and over. It's a used body. Like a used car. Yeah, but it, each time it goes back to the mother, of course, it's purified. And it comes back into existence, and it brings with it, though, these tendencies. What now? Okay, that takes care of the body, which is very basic and extremely important. What about the rest, though? What about the mental, the thinking? And, you know, how we think about things. And, you know, we don't all think alike. Some of us think about flowers, and some of us think about books, and some of us think about flying, and some of us think about skiing. You know, we don't all have the same inclinations. You know, so what about this mental state? What about the emotional state? What about this spiritualness of me, of you? Well, each according to where it has evolved. You can maybe remember a few weeks ago, I said something about consciousness does not evolve without effort. That's the training. Now, who makes the effort to evolve? The father? The mother? The son? The ego? The child? Huh? First of all, it's the ego that makes the effort. What else have you got? The ego hides something. And when the ego, through the training, you can shut it up, then this other comes forth. But through the ego, as much as it's important. Because you sit, you know, why? You have a desire. You want to know something else. You want to know something about yourself. You want to know something about this world in which you live. So you sit. What has allowed that? The ego. And maybe something has got the ego by the nose, you know, and says, it's time, you. But you, the child of nature, you make the effort. And according to the state of consciousness to which we have attained by the time we depart from this bodily form, so will be our surround after death. Now that's for the white rose. Okay. Now this Isha Upanishad, we're back to that. It indicates the two lines that we must follow in our effort. The knowledge and the action. And it is these two, the knowledge and the action, which lead eventually to what is called the supreme vision in the divine bliss. And these two, you know, the supreme truth, the supreme truth in this is represented by what is called Surya. Surya. Surya, the supreme truth and its illumination. That when you reach Surya, great god Surya. You know, in India, I've said this before, they have a name for everything. I mean, every eddy, every whirl of energy has got a name. So here now, this very high state, supreme truth, the truth of all truths, and its illumination, how the radiation from this one supreme truth flows through the universe. This is Surya. And the other, the action, is called Agni, the effort of the will. The divine will. Now, and this will purifies and perfects the human action. You see, Agni is involved in action. She purifies the action until each of us can say within ourselves, thy will be done in me. Thy will be done. So we have these two terms, and we have this form of invocation, you know, Surya and Agni, you know, it's like a, a mantra, a little prayer, an invocation to come forth so we can see, so we can be with, one with them. Huh? Now, the face of truth, Surya, the face of truth is covered with a brilliant golden lid. That do thou remove, O foster, for the law of truth, for sight. O foster, O soul seer, O ordainer, O illumining sun, O power of the father of creatures, marshal thy rays, draw together thy light, the luster which is thy most blessed form of all. That in thee I behold, the Purusha there and there, he am I. Conscious being, all conscious being, Surya. Conscious being is one, and it is indivisible in itself, of itself. In consciousness, we are one. There is one consciousness. So, of course, this is my delight in the pumpkin story. Everybody knows it, the pumpkin story. Then I won't say it again. Otherwise, you'll have to suffer through it. We are all one, and we all have the same name. Every one of us. Every person walking on this earth has the same name as I do. Every person walking on the earth has the same name that you do. And you know what that name is. Sure, it's I. We all say I. And we can only say it because we're conscious. And it comes from that consciousness. I am conscious. Okay. Now, conscious energy, the consciousness, this energy of consciousness, we say it makes a descent. It descends. There is a descent and there is an ascent. It comes down, and Christians call it the fall from grace. Not everything, of course, falls from grace. Lucifer did, you know, the morning star. Let us not look down upon him. He is the morning star. He defied and left. He descended, you see. And the prodigal son, when he goes home, his brother has never left. But for the prodigal son, when he comes home, the father for him kills the fatted calf. And the brother says, but you never did that for me. And the father says, there was no need. Yeah. Anyway, there is this outpouring of energy from the source. And it, you know, it's outpouring in us. Yeah. And see, there is this fullness in this emptiness. There is this fullness that overflows. And as it overflows out of its own tension, or, you know, it's kind of like a mountain spring. It begins to trickle out, you know, and then there's such a strength behind it, it pushes the water out, and it trickles down the mountainside. Okay, so there's this push out of all of this energy, from this force behind it. Now, as it moves, it becomes what we call less and less fine. It has, the further it goes from its source, the lower the frequencies and the longer the waves. The shorter the wave, the higher the frequency. Yeah. It's like there is this whole band spectrum of energy. At the top, we could say it's spirit or light, and at the bottom of the spectrum, we call it massed energy. You know, there's this fine consciousness. Yeah. And down here we have the consciousness maybe of a rock or a mountain. Hmm? Yeah. And, you know, it's like this spread. And you like, it's like a rubber band stretches out and out and out. And all of a sudden you can't stretch anymore. It goes whoop, and it bloop, and it's all one. It's never been anything else. It just appeared stretched out. Now, in all of this spectrum, you know, we occupy a place in it, a position in it. And it's sort of in the middle. There is this little tiny thing called objective self-consciousness. And above all of this objective self-consciousness, we have like X-ray, gamma rays, beta rays, alpha rays, you know, cosmic rays. And below this, we have got other kind of rays. I've forgotten what they are called right now. Oh, it's been a long time since I've done this. Anyway, at this state where we are, this objective self-consciousness state, this little tiny space position in this whole band spectrum, you know, this point, which is called man, objective self-consciousness, where man is on his 2 feet, finally. Mother has brought him along, you know, and finally there is something that stands up. And because it stands somehow or another together with it, it has a mind. It can think. The rest of natures are running around on 4 feet. But we're on 2 feet. And we're vertical. We're up. Upright. And we're beginning to move. We are beginning to move to another dependency. We have been dependent on the mother, and now we're going to move into dependency on the father. Until we actually become the son. We're now going to try to find out something about the father. So we have the Egyptian story of Isis and Horus. The mother, you know, the son wants, he knows his mother. He's come that far. He knows his mother. And he wants now to know something about his father. So the mother takes him, and together they find the different parts of the father. They never do find his elements of generation. Because in heaven there is no sex, you see. So this is always missing. We're androgynous. And at this point, the man takes himself in hand to make the return trip. So we say the prodigal son returns home. That's the story of the plot. It's all very briefly stated for all the work that is entailed. I can talk one morning and you can spend next 3 years, you know. Now, in this, what we call appearance, this world of appearance, this is a manifestation, This is the world of descent and ascent, which is pictured in the Bible as the angels going up and down this ladder. They're descending and ascending again, Which is, you know, the child's picture of it, you know. And within now this unity, because it is one band spread, not a whole lot of them, one band spread. Within this unity, there comes about some very complex rhythms. And there are harmonies. There are energies coming together and they're parting again. There are hierarchies of states, because it is a band spectrum. There are hierarchies of movement. There are eddies and there are whirls of energy. The descending or involutive, you know. And then there is the ascending or the evolution, evolutive. The highest of which we call spirit and the lowest of which we call matter, which is massed energy, Which one should think of as crystallized light, crystallized spirit? It's not just a piece of dirt to be kicked out of your way. It is that which is crystallized. That is everywhere. The spirit is the pure existence. You know, we called it Sat. You know, it's pure in its own self-awareness. And it is pure in its bliss, this Ananda, this Satchidananda. It is, it knows it is, and it delights in its isness. And that's why Zen has this, nothing is left but a smile. It's delight, you know. This Satchidananda, which contains in itself its purity, its awareness, and its delight. And this is the basis of you and me. Don't put it out there. This purity is you and me. Existence is you and me. Delight is you and me. I mean, we have a little taste of joy now and then, huh? It trickles down. Now, in our limited states and in our delusions, we have a deluded mind, of course. You know, how we're born and brought up. This is, what else could we have? You know, you're going to come through with this purity, with all this claptrap that goes on? Hardly. But in our limited states, we separate all of this with our ideas and our words and our concepts. So God is up there and matter is down there. And blah, 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 blah. We, you know the usual rigmarole. We create the division. We create the delusion. We create the limitation. We wallow around in our apparent opposites. This Supreme One, in its multiplicity, is still one. In its multiplicity, is from a point of view of, shall we say, creation, it is the world of becoming. The one in multiplicity is becoming, becoming being. Now, there is a power. By which the self-consciousness brings out of itself its potential. There is a power. You know, that brings it out. It's a force or an energy. And this is of the nature of the will. Now, not will as we understand it ordinarily. We look at will as determination sometimes, or as something that we pick up and put down again, such as we can say, well, I will have the willpower to do this. I have the willpower to do so and so. I will do such and such by my willpower. We speak about it and we look at it as if this power were something other than ourselves. It is something that I own. It's something that I have. We don't look at it as me, this willpower. This is not what is called will in the religious sense. You know, the will in the religious sense is power. It is inherent in you because it is inherent in being. And once you experience this will, the power of God, this willpower of God, you will never, ever forget it. It is power. Love is the same. It is a love. Power. What we know as love is very secondary to it. What we know as will or determination is very secondary to this will of God, this willpower. I'm getting to be too long. You want me to quit? Well, some of you are indifferent, and some of you say, keep on. Anyway, that's why I'll keep on. The movement of existence. Willpower is the movement of existence in a self-conscious state. That will knows itself. It names itself. The moment you experience it, you know immediately what it is because it says what it is, and it doesn't say a word. There is a signature to it. And this will is expressed as a force. And by this will, it also has another name. It is called Chit Shakti, Mother. And of this force, this energy, that when we experience it, we say it is willpower, the power of God. It is by this power that we can call Shakti, by which the world is created, by this will. Now, Surya is the Vedic truth. It means supreme truth. And here we are back to what one could call intuition, or the gnosis. Gnosis known as a power, the power of supreme truth. And it works in its own law, in identity of the supreme self. Gnosis, whose nature is seeing, not conceiving, but seeing. Therefore, I always say, you know, when you sit, don't think. Ignore the thinking, ignore the thinking. You see. Surya. You don't see the person standing there saying, I'm Surya, you know. But you see, if you can drop your words, is this supreme truth through the power called gnosis or Surya. See? The power by which God sees himself and sees all is Surya. The Gnostic, the gnosis, intuition. Now the face of truth is covered with a brilliant golden lid. Now it's covered from our objective self-conscious point of view. It isn't really covered at all. You know, it's just we think it is because we can't see it. This is human consciousness. We are mental beings. We have a mind. The little dog and kitty are not mental beings. We are. And our ordinary states, you know, we have all this mental sight that we have. We have mental sight. But the mental sight is all made up of our concepts and our precepts, all this going around in the mind. And these are what we call our means of knowledge. And some people consider them as rays of truth, but they are not the truth of existence. No.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.